Utley for appellant, James Anderson for appellee. Argument on the merits.
Mr. Sudley, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
I understand that you're asking for 15 minutes for rebuttal. Is that the time frame you want?
Much time as the court would allow.
All right. Well, to usually the extent you don't use up your time in the opening, you'll have time for rebuttal.
I usually find rebuttal to be more useful than the original argument.
Please proceed.
I'd like to start, if I may, with the directions that I received from my client day before yesterday by letter. He says, one thing I want you not to forget is to argue about the shirt had the blood only on the back, which tells that I tried to make my way to get to the car and leave the trouble, and Bill Reflong followed me and crapped me from behind. I should have immediately come over and looked at Exhibit 34, which is the shirt in question. And this is relevant to the issue of the prejudice that might have occurred from the in-the-hole evidence. Weight of the evidence that prosecutor spent three pages in at the end of the answering brief and 18 pages at the beginning.
Let me ask you about that incident. The question was presented. The question or the whole reference came out on the direct examination of Mr. Lean, correct?
Lean, the whole business?
Right.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
All right. And the questions came out in the context of the prosecutor laying a foundation for getting the conversation between Mr. Lean, the purported conversation between Mr. Lean and the defendant, into evidence.
Yes.
Doesn't the prosecutor have to lay a foundation for the conversation by getting out the time, the place, who was involved in the conversation, and wasn't the whole reference as part of that foundation?
The time and the place could be OCCC in early December 2005. That's all he needs to, that he was together with the defendant in OCCC. Doesn't need to say, I was in the hole where they put all the really bad guys.
Well, why not? Isn't that where the conversation took place?
Yes, but it
so
went.
So is it factually incorrect?
The inference is incorrect that he was in the hole because of misconduct.
Well, but the statement of the witness is that he is in the hole because he's a management problem.
No. Yeah.
What is the hole? The hole is a place where the prison puts people who are management problems.
Yes.
So he's talking about himself, the witness.
And anybody else in the hole
is
the inference, yeah. And that's what everybody would presume that ever heard of the hole is where they put the bad guy.
Well, I guess my question is, why is that misconduct? The state has to lay a foundation for introducing the conversation. He's laying a foundation. What the witness answers is not an untrue statement. So why is that misconduct on the part of the prosecution?
It is untrue that my client was put into the hole because of misconduct.
But the witness doesn't say that.
He says that the people in the hole have been put there because of misconduct,
which includes. But he's referring to himself.
The actual testimony was more general than that. It was, what is the hole? That's where they put the bad guys.
Right, and that's in the context of, what are you doing in the hole?
Then what were you doing in the hole? I was in there because I flooded my cell. I was guilty of
right,
misconduct.
So the witness
I was guilty of misconduct, and so were all the rest of the guys in there guilty of misconduct.
Does he say that?
It's abundantly clear from that evidence. Everybody, I mean, the hole is where they put people who have committed misconduct. I was put there because of misconduct. The defendant was in there.
Did defense counsel attempt to clarify that on cross-examination or on Mr. Sonis's testimony?
I don't believe he did. I mean, that's their assertion, but I think he just made it worse. He should have objected immediately when they're talking, and he had noticed that they would be trying to bring that whole evidence in because he did it in the motion for involuntariness, which is not part of the record, unfortunately. But
did the prosecution in closing argument argue that because that the defendant was a management problem because Mr. Lean testified that he talked to him in the hole?
I don't think so, Your Honor, but I don't think that's necessary. The prejudice is resulting from the fact that it's that my client is in the hole. If it can be prejudice to see a defendant in handcuffs, it's got to be prejudice to say that a client, that a defendant is in the hole. But anyway, to get to the weight of the evidence, I mean, we have the shirt. Now, I should have come right over here and looked at that shirt, which is supposed to be Exhibit 34, but I didn't do that on Monday and yesterday. When I got to the point, it was too late to come and to look at it. I do have the photographs of the blue and black and blue Nike shirt. I presume it's Exhibit 34. The court can look at Exhibit 34. If this is not Exhibit 34, then there's a Rule 40 motion coming up. But I believe Exhibit 34 will show there's absolutely no blood on the right, this area on the right side of the shirt. Now, if he's facing the victim and stabbing him in the neck and the blood is spurting out, this is where the blood is going to come, on the shirt, on the right-hand side. This side is completely devoid. There's a few splotches of blood down on the left side. There's a splotch on the neck collar right here. There's a big splotch on the back of the left sleeve, and then all down the back is all blood. This is completely and entirely consistent of him stabbing the guy over his shoulder. That's where the blood's coming from, right there in his neck. He's stabbing him over the shoulder. And you know, why the defense counsel didn't bring this shirt out and hold it up in front of each and every one of those witnesses that was saying that he was standing there stabbing him from the front, and ask them how did the blood get all over his back and all over the collar on the left side and all over the back of his left sleeve.
So the argument on the shirt goes to ineffectiveness of counsel, well, not insufficiency of evidence. Right?
Well, there's no I'm not saying there's an insufficiency of evidence. I'm saying that the evidence is not overwhelming to the point that that was harmless error about the whole. I do think it was also an ineffective assistance of counsel not to zero in on this shirt as well, but it's on the two issues, the whole.
So in other words, the shirt, you're raising that to show that if there's error in the whole reference, it was not harmless.
That's right.
Because it was a close case.
It was a close case. And, I mean, it goes...
But what was that shirt in evidence?
Yeah, 34. It's in evidence as 34.
So the jury had an opportunity to look at it in deliberation.
They did, but did they? I mean, I still haven't looked at it. I don't think Mr. Gu paid much attention to it. I don't think prosecutor. I mean, if I was a prosecutor and I looked at that shirt, I wouldn't be trying to say the guy's stabbing him from the front while face to face. I wouldn't be doing that.
Counsel, you're a defense attorney. Isn't ineffectiveness of counsel better raised by a Rule 40 motion where defense counsel can come and appear explain why he did or didn't do things as opposed to raise it on appeal with an inadequate record?
Yeah.
But
yes, yes.
And if you raise it on appeal and lose, you may be preempted from then raising it below on a Rule 40, right?
Yeah. Well, this was the one issue that I was instructed to raise, and I raised it. So I think there's enough there already.
But, I mean, what counsel does and doesn't do may have a tactical reason. He may not want to focus on somebody being at OCCC and have discussions on that and just let it slide by. I mean, it could be a tactical decision, could it not? And we don't know unless we ask Mr. Good,
I
correct?
I can't imagine why anybody would want their client to be represented as having been a bad guy in the hole.
Yeah, but when you're objecting to it,
as a tactical matter,
you know, you want the jury to focus on that, regardless of
how
the judge rules.
I don't want. He didn't object.
Yeah, well, he may had a tactical reason not to object. We'd have to ask him, wouldn't we?
He should have done a motion in limine, actually, because he knew it was coming. Yeah.
And shouldn't we ask him why he didn't?
Yeah.
Wouldn't that be fair to him?
Well.
Wouldn't that have a more complete record for the court?
Yeah, it would.
In other words, the fact that Mr. Lean was in the hole, wouldn't that tend to negate or attack his credibility?
quite frankly, I don't think the jury paid much attention to Mr. Lean's his testimony that my client made a confession, because if they had, they probably would have found him guilty of murder, because that's what he was supposedly said to Mr. Lean, that I'm guilty of murder, and they found him guilty of manslaughter. So I don't think that the jury found him very credible, but that part of his testimony
The defense lawyer may not know that up front.
No.
So it may be a tactical decision. He wants to get out the fact that Mr. Lean's in the hole, because that would tend to discredit Mr. Lean.
I think there was plenty to discredit Mr. Lean about, other than the hole. I mean, the fact that he didn't mention it when he's negotiating the plea agreement until after the first trial. This is the first time he brought it up. He brought it up, 2 years later, after the whole thing, after the first trial. Just completely made up stuff. I mean, there's plenty of ways to attack Mr. Lean's credibility than the fact that he was in the hole.
Counsel, can I ask you a question on a different topic?
Yes.
You've raised an issue regarding Lean as an agent of the state.
Yes.
I didn't see any legal authorities for that proposition. And is there a test from another jurisdiction that you're asking us to apply in this case?
Well, the agreement, Your Honor, this is... And volume 2, page 215, paragraph 2, the witness agrees to actively assist HPD and the Department of Prosecuting Attorney in their ongoing investigation into the death of both reference complainants Robert E. Lee and Percy Baker. These are not this case, but he is agreeing to be an investigator on two other cases. Therefore, he's agreed to be an agent for the police.
Okay, but now, there's no agreement with respect to Mr. Sanis, is that correct?
This agreement does not specifically mention the Sanis case. It does, however, on page 217, it says, upon completion of the murder trials, the Department of Prosecuting Attorney will appear before the Hawaii Paroling Authority and respectfully request that the defendant be placed on parole with credit for time served. And then
what's the effective date of that agreement?
The document is dated December 28. It was signed on March 16.
Which is after the observation in this case?
Well after the alleged statement. However, and at the voluntariness hearing, Mr. Lean denied that there was any negotiations as far as this plea agreement prior to the statements being given. But when we get to trial, he admits that they were negotiating this agreement way back in November.
Do you have authority for the fact that if you're negotiating with the state to become a cooperating witness, that makes you an agent of the state?
I don't have a case, no. But that's my argument, that it was his goal to be he was negotiating a deal in which he was going to be an investigator, and he was, if it happened. I don't for a minute concede that this statement was ever made, because I think it's quite obvious that it was made up after the first trial. But if it was, he was trying to become an investigator. So what's he going to do? He's going to end that he elicited this statement from my client, if it was made. All right.
Can I ask you a question on the interpreter issue?
Yes.
I'm just trying to figure out what the record shows with respect to that situation. In addition to the interpreter for the witness, did the defendant also have an interpreter present at trial?
Yes.
And was there any indication that interpreter was not familiar with the particular dialect of the witnesses?
There was one point where the witness interpreter asked my client's interpreter to help her.
Right, but I'm asking, was there any indication that the defendant's interpreter had difficulty understanding what the witness was saying?
I don't know that. No, there's no indication of that.
And was this particular trial, was it recorded, or videotaped, or is there some record in terms of exactly what the witness said during the trial?
I tried to get tapes of the actual testimony so that, you know, we might be able to see what was actually said, but unfortunately, they said they didn't have any. I don't know if they do or not, but, you know, there were lots and lots of, I mean, the state wants to say, well, it's just this one word. Was it anger or confusion? And that's just the one word that was made, the mistake was made or not. But, you know, it's all through that testimony of Mr. What's his name? Ephraim. All through his testimony, she's making mistakes.
Well, how do we know that, though?
Because they're on the record. There's the first one, you know, about the anger and confusion at page, this is on the November 10th, I believe, on page 78. That's where the original mistake occurred, anger and confusion. Then on page 109, Your Honor, may I ask the witness to rephrase his statement? I'm sorry, can we pause, Mr. Gu? The court, can you interpret what he just said, or did you not hear him, the interpreter? Well, you know, because the dialect, yeah, it's kind of hard for me because he's from other islands, so I'm trying to catch up on his, the court. Tell you what, you want to ask the question again and interpret the question and then interpret his answer? Mr. Gu, can I confer with the interpreter? Maybe she heard, I want to hear what he said. Conferring.
It's not on the record. That suggests she was having difficulty, but not that she was misinterpreting what the witness said.
She couldn't interpret what he said. She asked him to rephrase what he said. She couldn't interpret it. Then on page 26, again, she says, let me rephrase. And then on page 129, and you're drunk at this point still, right? The interpreter, I'm sorry, and you're still drunk at this time. When you say the man is running at you with a knife, I do not recall. On page 130, the interpreter, Your Honor, may I ask the witness to rephrase the answer? The court, I'm sorry, did you ask him to rephrase or did he answer? The interpreter, I'm asking if you can allow me to ask him to rephrase his statement so I can interpret. Page 132, Your Honor, may I ask the other interpreter to translate this word, because I'm not familiar with it. She also, I mean, it's not anything to do with her interpretation, but there was also an occasion where her cell phone went off. I hope my cell phone is turned off. On page 87, there's a couple of, many times, oh, that's not on 87, that's page 87. I thought it was off for the record.
Just curious, counsel. I don't know if I caught it in the brief. What islands were the defendant from?
Micronesia.
No, from what islands within Chuuk? Because you're talking about dialects within Chuuk. Yeah. So can you tell me which islands they were from?
No, I don't have that. It's not on the record, and I don't know. And we don't. I wouldn't know what island the interpreter was from either. I think this could have been gotten into more. And there's several times when Mr. Gu asked, what did what? He didn't hear what was said, and then the interpreter answers. I don't know who's supposed to answer that question, if it's the interpreter or the witness or the court or the reporter, but the interpreter took it upon herself to answer those questions. So I think, you know, all through, it's just a terrible mess. And I don't think you can hold it that there was a fair interpretation there. Thank you very much.
May it please the court, James Anderson for the state. John Lane was never an agent for the state. He had a cooperation agreement for two interim murder cases. His testimony is, I just gave this to you. John Lane. And my role in this case is to find out whether the court's finding that John Lane was not an agent of the state is clearly erroneous. The defense has not even made the evidentiary portion of that of that hearing a part of the record. So he can't prove otherwise, one way or the other. I'm left with just the record as it is, and there's no indication that John Lane was anything but a jailhouse snitch.
Counsel?
Yes.
In regards to adequacy of the record, do you think the record is adequate to address the ineffectiveness of counsel claims?
There are four of them, Your Honor.
Do we have an adequate record? Should we address them or not?
All right. Well, Your Honor, I think the first one is that the failure to object to the admission as testified to by Lane. Yes, there's an adequate record for that. He did not object to testimony that Lane was in the hole. I think there's adequate evidence for that because that wasn't prejudicial at all. At the very most, if the jury inferred that defendant was a management problem because he was in the hole, it was for a rules infraction. He flooded his cell. He took a bath in his cell. It's a huge leap going from a rules infraction to a murderer.
But the inference is not prejudicial to Lane. The inference would be prejudicial to the defendant.
No, that's what I'm saying. If, in fact, the inference was because Lane and defendant were in the hole at the time, and therefore Lane was defendant was a management problem as well, it was the only inkling the jury had as what constituted a management problem was a rules infraction. That's all.
Well, did the prosecution at that point know that the reason why the defendant was in the hole was because he was simply awaiting bed space?
Well,
is that in the record? Did the prosecution know that at the time?
Well, I'm sure, but that wasn't brought out. It was actually clarified during cross-examination, at the inception of cross-examination, when it was asked, are people coming into the facility in danger as the general population, those coming into the general population? The answer was from Lane, no, not in the hole.
Right, but there's no testimony that people who come into the prison are placed in the hole pending their assignment to a particular
no, there's
facility.
No, there's not. There's only the inference.
Your reference to that passage for us to draw the inference you want us to draw is really a stretch, isn't it?
Okay, fine. But still, what remains is what constitutes a management problem on this record, and no one's to speculate any further, I think, can't go beyond the record, is that it was a rules infraction. He took a bath in his sink.
Well, my question is it a fair inference from Mr. Lean's testimony that the defendant was in the hole because he was a management problem?
No, I think it went just to him.
If it was a fair inference, wouldn't the prosecution have an obligation to correct the record? Tell the judge, find some way to stipulate into evidence that the reason why the defendant was in the hole was because he was awaiting bed space.
Well, of course that would be best, Your Honor, but I think it was so fleeting that I don't know if even the jury caught that point, you know, that the defendant was a management problem as well because he was in the hole.
And did the state ever argue in closing that the Mr. Lean's testimony indicates that the defendant was a management problem?
No, not at all. Not at all. Not even close. The cautionary instruction to Lean's credibility, that's the third issue of ineffective assistance. I don't think it was necessary because it was thoroughly brought out during direct. Lane's criminal history and the cooperating agreement. Defense counsel on cross did the same, and not only that, but the several punishments that he could be facing, 100 years almost, with extended terms, and the court's instructions as to how the jury was to assess the credibility of witnesses who lied, who partially lied, and so on, Your Honor. So I think the jury could sufficiently gauge Lean's credibility without a cautionary instruction I don't even know what that would be as it is, anyway.
Didn't the court give the jury a good instruction on credibility of witnesses?
Yes, it did. And it also included an interpreter, too, right before the general asked, you know, how they were to assess generally a credibility witness. The court told the jury that it was to view an interpreter as the same as any other witness as well. Going to the interpreter issue, there was but one errant misinterpretation when the interpreter, Ms. Irons, corrected herself. No one else heard that. Certainly defendant didn't hear that. She said He said confused, not angry. Upon examination by the court ascertained that there was no problem in a sense. The dialects were different in the islands, but she was, you know, and he would mumble, you know, Paulus would mumble on occasion, and she would have to gather it and maybe ask him to rephrase. But other than that, essentially, she had no problem accurately interpreting the questions.
What was the procedure by which the interpreter was qualified?
It wasn't,
as
Your
a
Honor.
Legitimate interpreter.
Your Honor, you know, under 604, of course, it refers to 702, how an expert is generally qualified. I've never seen a record. I've been doing this for 22 years. I've never seen a record where an interpreter is qualified as an expert, as an expert would be.
So there was nothing in the record with respect to what her qualifications were in terms of being able to interpret in the first place?
Only that she understood Chuuk. That's it.
And she did could, the defendant also have an interpreter during the trial?
Defendant had a different interpreter. Ms. Irons was one of three interpreters in the trial. The first one was during voir dire of the panel, the jury panel. The second one, I think Ms. Irons interpreted for Paulus, Otto, and Esteras. And then there was another interpreter that interpreted for a defendant, and maybe earlier in the trial, too. I'm not sure, as one other witness. I'm not sure.
So, if I get it right, while Paulus is interpreting and Irons is doing that interpretation of the witness, the defendant has his own interpreter who presumably is interpreting the English translation of what Paulus is saying.
You know, I don't know that. I don't know that. I only know that he had his own interpreter, of course, during his testimony. But no, I don't know that. No, I'm sorry. I
misunderstood. You don't know whether there's an interpreter sitting next to him during trial?
No, I don't. I don't. But you would think that he would understand the Chuuk dialect, being Chuuk himself.
So he may understand the Chuuk dialect, but he may not, if he's not proficient in English, he may not understand that what the interpreter's English interpretation is accurate or inaccurate.
Good point.
So you don't know what the record shows?
No, I don't.
And there's no indication that the witness's testimony was recorded or preserved in some fashion so that we now can go back and get a great expert on Chuukese and listen to what the witness say and compare that to what the interpreter said?
Not to my knowledge, Your Honor. Okay. I would ask this court if it would be good enough to point out its further concerns. I'd be happy to address them to the best of my ability if you... And thank you. I'd rest in my brief.
Can I just say a few words about he did have an interpreter there assisting him. Now, as to the value of this, I don't know, because they're supposed to be simultaneously interpreting. Now, I don't know how it could logistically happen. If you've got your phones, then you can only listen to one language or the another. You can't listen to a witness and a translator, and then you have another translator translating back into Chuukese. It would just be completely confusing, I would think. But I do think there needs to be a recorded record made when there is interpreters. And these Chuukese interpreters, they're not certified, because there aren't enough of them. And there's apparently a lot of Chuukese people getting in trouble and need interpreters. And I've had quite a few, and not very many of them are certified. You know, they have.
Now, the defense lawyer trial made a motion for mistrial in connection with this angry versus confused interpretation, correct?
Yes.
Was there any other point besides that particular issue in which the defense counsel argued to the judge that the interpreter was misinterpreting the witness's testimony or made another motion for a mistrial based upon other aspects of the interpretation?
At the time he made the motion for mistrial, there was only the two prior incidents. Three more that occurred after his motion, which he never renewed.
But did he object to that?
No, he didn't object, and he didn't renew his motion. It's more ineffective assistance, but so I think that really something needs to be done to provide better interpretation, and that wouldn't hurt. Thank you.
Take this case under submission.
All rise. Court is now in recess.